STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Hello, friends, and welcome to the show. Greg Kokel, your host here on Stand to Reason. And a couple of weeks ago, we... And actually more than that, on a couple of occasions, we've engaged this question that keeps popping up and will probably be doing so for a while, this whole question of whether the God of Islam is the same as the God of Christianity and Judaism. I think I covered the basis pretty well, at least from my own point of view on this in the past, but I have an article here that is just worth making reference to. It's called "The Same God Debate is Too Important to Leave to Philosophers," and it was authored by Lydia McGrew, who identifies herself as a housewife and homeschooling mother living in the Midwest. Now, I know this name because I know her husband, Tim McGrew. And Tim is a fine philosopher. I think he's from University of Western Michigan or somewhere thereabouts, and a Christian. And so Lydia has taken on this issue in the article that appears in Bible and Theology. I'm chuckling because there's more to her creds here than I mentioned. It says Lydia McGrew is a housewife and a homeschooling mother living in the Midwest. And then it says she has recently published Internalism and Epistemology, The Architecture of Reason, Routledge Press. Well, all right, not exactly Goodnight Moon, is it? So this is one smart housewife and homeschooling mother, and of course she evidences it in the material, in the piece that she's written. And she's made a couple of points here that may echo some things that I've said, but they're worth repeating here. One point that she makes is that the argument that the God of Islam and the God of Christianity, or the God of the Bible, or the same God, it rests on, it depends on a very thin notion of worshiping the same God. And I've made this point before. Just because we say we worship the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and they say that they worship the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, it doesn't really establish anything. Just because one says that doesn't mean, you mean because we refer to God by the same, in a sense, moniker or description, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, well, then it's a fait accompli, it's done with, it's all that needs to be said? No. She also mentions that the theory trivializes all differences among religions. And any intelligent non-philosopher is free to reject it out of hand and go on believing that Muslims and Christians do not worship the same God. Look at the difference of our religion. They're profound. Now, I know the president gave a speech recently at a mosque somewhere. I heard excerpts from it. And the thrust of at least one aspect of the speech was that Christianity and Judaism and Islam are pretty much three peas in a pod. They are largely on par with each other. And I think this point Lydia McGrew has made applies to that speech. It trivializes the differences among the religions, and they are significant. And being monotheistic is not enough to set aside all the significant distinctives. She also makes the point that... unlike the previous point, acknowledges the importance of divine attributes in deciding whether the adherents of two religions worship the same God. but it makes certain perfect sense to ask why just these attributes should be considered sufficient while others about which Muslims and Christians differ as necessary. Okay, that's a good point. I got it. And that is, people can say, well, look, they agree on A, B, and C. That makes them basically the same. Well, what about D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O? All of those differences. I guess that's just another way of saying trivializing the differences, but that's important to keep in mind. Why is it that these things that you've isolated are the things that matter in identifying these as basically the same God being worshipped in each case? And she adds, Islam doesn't just say that God doesn't happen to be triune, or that God didn't in fact come down as man. Islam says that God cannot be triune or incarnate. You catch that? Cannot be triune or incarnate. Actually, to say that God became a man is to commit just about the worst sin, the sin of shirk, of identifying God with something finite. Well, that puts it in a different category, it seems to me. There's also another problem, she writes. One influential school of Islamic thought holds that Allah, by his will alone, could make what we call evil into what we call good, a position known as extreme moral voluntarism. So what is evil and what is good is just a matter of God defining it, and he can change his mind and reverse all the definitions tomorrow. That works. For them, does that work for us? No. On our view, God is good in his nature. It's a fixed characteristic of his nature. He cannot change. He cannot sin. It's impossible for him to sin. That's a big difference. Now, she does make a point about the question of Jews, and I thought this was a contribution that was important. So I'm going to read to you a couple of paragraphs. What about the God of the Jews? And if we make the Trinity to be a vital distinction between Islam and Christianity, such that the Muslims cannot be worshiping the same God as ours because their God is not triune, this seems to then apply with the equal force to Jews. Now, I have mentioned in the past that I do think Jews do worship the same God, even though they deny the Trinity, because they're in a different, entirely different category than Muslims who deny the Trinity. And I've had my way of expressing it, but Lydia McGrew does the same thing. She makes the same point in a little different way, so I thought I'd pass on her thoughts. She writes, finally, there's the what about the Jews argument. This is often used as if it is a knockdown response to any mention of the Trinity in this context. It's importantly true that Jesus was a Jew, that all of his apostles were Jews, and that Christianity originated in the context of first century Judaism. It's vitally true that Jesus came to reveal God who selected the Jews as his chosen people, and that Jesus is the promised Messiah sent by Yahweh himself. What she's establishing here is all of these very strong historical connections between Christianity and Judaism and theological connections between Christianity and Judaism. These religious views are woven together, is the point that she's making. The God of the Old Testament, she writes, is, Christians affirm, the God of the New Testament. Doesn't that mean that Christians worship the God of the Jews? Of course. Then ask, how can Trinitarianism even be relevant to the question of whether Muslims and Christians worship the same God? After all, Abraham didn't believe in the Trinity, and modern Orthodox Jews reject the Trinity. But here, for once, philosophy can be helpful because, she writes, one thing philosophers do well is making distinctions. And the answer to this is that, in one sense, Christians and modern religious Jews worship the same God, and in another sense, they do not. Old Testament Jews, of course, didn't reject the Trinity and the Incarnation because those doctrines hadn't been revealed. If someone emphatically rejects those truths about God and explicitly worships a God as non-triune and non-incarnate, this makes perfectly good case that, in one sense, such a person doesn't worship the same God whom Christians worship. However, in another sense, Christians can say to modern religious Jews, the true God who called your forefathers out of the land of Egypt, who gave the law at Sinai, who chose you as his beloved chosen people, really is the one who sent Yeshua the Messiah to die for sins. We worship the God who really did found Judaism thousands of years ago, who really did give the Torah, and we are here to tell you more about him. Now, that, I think, is a very important distinction. Look at all of these ways. We really do believe every single one of these things that you believe about God. We have one difference. Well, maybe a little bit more than that, but you get my point. We're connected in all these ways, theologically and historically. Now, we want to tell you a little bit more about the God that you worship that you didn't know about. And that is, he's triune, of course, and that he became a man. And she continues then, in that historical sense, we can say that the God whom we worship is the God of the Jews, though those who have not accepted Jesus do not, of course, agree. But notice, nothing like this is true of Islam. God didn't really reveal himself to Muhammad. Muhammad was not a prophet of God. Truth matters. It isn't enough that Muslims think that the being who revealed himself to Abraham also spoke to Muhammad. Since that isn't true, there is no real historical connection in the acts of God himself between the Allah of Islam and the one true God. But there is a real historical connection to the acts of God himself between Judaism and Christianity. So there you have it. I think that's really nicely put and well thought through. And if you got lost a little bit in some of the concepts of the wording, let me just revisit the basic point with regards to the God of the Jews versus the God of the Muslims and the God of Christianity. We can say that we worship the same God as the Jews, and not this not being true of Muslims, because at virtually every single point of the history of the Jews, we acknowledge all of those facts. And we acknowledge all that the Jews hold true about God, not just that he's simply the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but that everything in their corpus of revelation we hold to be true. And then add a clarification in the New Testament that God became man in the person of Jesus. That puts Judaism in an entirely different category than it puts Islam, okay? Islam has none of those connectors. And so there is no good reason for us to believe that they're worshiping the same God. And point Lydia McGrew made, if you do hold that, you've got to acknowledge that Muhammad is God's prophet, and Jesus is God's prophet, but Muhammad said Jesus didn't die on the cross. So now what? Okay, that's a pretty important detail, right? Okay. Looking at the clock here, probably a good idea to go to a quick break, and then I'll come back and get calls on Stand to Reason, so stay with us, please.
If you lack the time to wade through thick volumes to get a solid grasp of tough topics, STR has a short and sweet solution. Our Ambassador's Guides are quick reads that give you easily digestible answers to crucial concerns you face as a Christian ambassador. Each volume in this series equips you with the information and outlook you need to understand an issue confronting Christians today. When you visit the STR store at str.org, you'll find a library of Ambassador's Guides, including guides to Mormonism, Islam, Postmodernism, the New Atheists, Pluralism, Understanding Homosexuality, and The Voice of God. To order copies and become a better equipped and more knowledgeable ambassador, visit the online store at str.org or call 800-2-REASON. That's 800-273-2766.
Are you a student with hard questions about God, Jesus, or the Bible? Or do you have a student in your life who is asking questions that you aren't prepared to answer? Then it's time to pay a visit to the student resources page at strnextgen.com, where you'll find tons of fresh and compelling information for students, parents, and youth leaders. It's a rich collection of articles and videos, including responses to common objections about the Christian faith. And there's even a place where you can invite me, Brett Kunkel, to speak at your local school or church. So head over to the student resources page today. Just visit strnextgen.com.
Last reminder here, this weekend coming up, February 12th and 13th, the AMP Conference with Reason to Believe. It's going to be in Pomona, California, and I think that's Friday and Saturday, right? Or Friday evening and all day Saturday. A great, unbelievable lineup. I would love just to go and sit in the gallery of this one. Hugh Ross, of course, founder and president of Reasons to Believe, is speaking. J. Warner Wallace will be with him, along with Sean McDowell and Fuzz Rana of RTB. Mark Middleberg is coming out from Colorado or wherever he lives now. Mary Jo Sharp will be there from Houston. Abdu Murray flying in from Detroit. I mean, what a great lineup of fabulous people. So I hope you can make it. If you want to make it, just go to ampconference.com. And when you sign up, the promo code for 10% off is simply Stand to Reason. How about that? My sheet here, it's got it all caps, no spaces, so plug it in that way and you'll get your 10% discount to be part of that. Amy Hall will be there for Stand to Reason. I think we'll have a table, and we won't have. Well, you might see Amy walking around then, but in any event, I'm sure you'll enjoy the conference. All right, let's go to Renee in Ohio somewhere. Renee, welcome to the show.
Hi, Greg. Thank you.
Sure. Welcome.
Greg, I have a question about the two Bible verses and trying to get a better understanding of them. It has to do with the Ark of the Covenant. The first Bible verse is from 1 Kings chapter 8, verse 9.
Yeah.
And the other one is from Hebrews 9, 4. And if you could just kind of get a better understanding, it's like what happened to the manna and Aaron's staff.
Well, what the text says, let me do it in reverse just because I think it'll be a little easier to make the point. In Hebrews chapter 9, verse 4, it's talking about the Ark of the Covenant. And it says that behind the second veil, this is in the tabernacle, in the Holy of Holies, inside the center of the temple, was a golden altar of incense, and the Ark of the Covenant. So it's this box that has cherubim kind of over it, so to speak. It's covered on all sides. I'm reading here from Hebrews 9. In gold, in which was a golden jar holding the manna, and Aaron's rod, which had budded, and the tables of the covenant. That would be the Ten Commandments on stone. I just want to make a look here in the margin here, verse 4. I think that there's probably some place in the law where it specifies. I got too many references here, so I can't dig it out. But where it maybe Exodus 31 through 5, where it specifies that these are the things that are supposed to be in the Ark of the Covenant. And there's a reason for that. I'm just going to it really quickly here. Exodus 31 through 5. Cover it with gold, I guess, you know, two rings. Okay, that particular verse doesn't specify. But here's my understanding. There were three main things that were inside the covenant, the Ark of the Covenant, and that was the law, which Israel had broken, the manna, which the Jews had complained about, and the rod that had budded, which demonstrated who was to be leader, and this all of these reflected or represented areas of rebellion by the Jews. They broke the law, they rejected the leadership, and they rejected the provision. And these things inside the Ark of the Covenant represented essentially Israel's sin. And then when the angels, the seraphim, are right there, kind of looking down in the Shekinah glory, the presence of God is hovering over it. You see God looking down and seeing their sin. And on the platform in between there, at the top of the ark, that's where the blood went. So the blood would cover the sin, symbolically here, and God would see the blood, and he wouldn't see the rebellion, and he would be appeased, he would be satisfied, okay? That's the whole balance there, but you have there's a problem, right? And that's the 1 Kings 8 passage.
Right.
And here we see a description of the ark being brought into the temple in the time of Solomon. And it says in verse 9 that there was nothing in the ark except the two tablets of stone, which Moses put there at Horeb, where the Lord made a covenant with the sons of Israel when they came out of the land of Egypt. Wow, so what happened to the manna, and what happened to the staff that had budded?
Right.
And the answer is we don't know for sure. It's not, in a sense, a contradiction, but those things went missing. And I'm not sure if you recall earlier, this is the time of Solomon, but during the time of, I'm just trying to think who, early on with Samuel, when probably in the early part of 1 Samuel, we know that the ark was stolen by the Canaanites. The Philistines, I think, got it.
Yeah.
And they had it for, it caused them nothing but trouble.
Right.
And eventually it came back, and it was restored. So it is very possible, it seems to me, that the ark had those things in them when it was taken, and when it came back, it was missing some items.
Okay.
They might have been pilfered by people. I don't know. It's simple conjecture here. What we have in the book of Hebrews is a description of the way it was set up originally, the way it was supposed to be. And all of those things representing those categories of rebellion that I just described. I mean, that's somewhat interpretive, I think. I haven't gone personally back over the details in the law that pertain to those three things in the Ark of the Covenant. But that's my understanding of what they represented. Some of these things you kind of have to glean from them. I don't know if you go back to the original characterization of it, and that would mean following some of the references here in your own Bible, if you have a cross-reference Bible to see. And I don't have time to do that right now, but there's a lot of verses there. And so
right, there is. Yeah.
Maybe there's some explanation about that. It might be worthwhile to check it out. But regardless, the reason there's a distinction between Hebrews chapter 9 and, 1 Kings chapter 8,
yeah.
Is that it looks like once it was set up that it was supposed to be set up, a la Hebrews 9, it got the ark got captured, and who knows what happened to it then? I don't, and who knows where it is now? I don't know what happened when the temple was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar. It might have been taken then, along with a whole bunch of other stuff that the text says was taken. So I'm just not sure what the status is right now. But that whole issue made a great movie about 20 years ago, if you recall. That was a lot of fun, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. I enjoyed that movie. Greg, thanks very much for your answer. My wife and I were discussing last night, and like you said, it looks like Hebrews talks about the way it originally was, and it just sounds like in 1 Kings it's not there anymore.
Yeah, so that's it. And it's hard to know all the particulars, but it doesn't create a problem for us, but it does raise a question, a curiosity, and maybe someday we'll find it out. Some people have speculated very, very casually because there's nothing to it as far as we know. But maybe as time goes on and things get crazier and God begins to work more radically in certain areas, maybe that will be uncovered. Maybe that will be revealed. Maybe in some archaeological dig in Jerusalem, they'll actually uncover the Ark of the Covenant. Wouldn't that be something?
It would be.
Yeah. The Ark does not have supernatural powers, though. What had power was God himself, who manifested himself in Shekinah glory over the Ark. That was kind of a theophany, kind of like the burning bush. You know, God shows himself or makes himself present somewhere. But the glory has departed long ago, so I don't think there's going to be anything magical about the Ark if they do find it. And it'll just be a very interesting archaeological object, and would be nice. It would be great in terms of substantiating something about the history of Israel, but chances are it'll never show up. We'll see.
Okay.
All righty.
Well, great. Thank you very much. We appreciate your ministry, and God bless.
Thank you so much. God bless you, and say hi to your wife for me.
Will do. Thank you.
That was good. I enjoyed that conversation. All right, let's go to Vancouver, Canada, and this is Dave in Vancouver. Hi, Dave.
Hey, Greg.
How are you doing?
Not too bad. How are you?
Pretty good.
I'm a long-time listener, first-time caller, and my challenge to you has to do with your comment about a pink elephant in the mind but not in the brain, and you say, I could be thinking of a pink elephant, but you can't break open my skull and dig into my brain and find a pink elephant in there.
Yeah, it's not quite precisely what I say. I'm not saying I could be thinking of it. I can be picturing a pink elephant.
Picturing.
And so the picture is vivid enough that in my mind's eye I can actually see it. So I behold something real. That is, I'm not beholding the elephant, I'm beholding the image of the elephant, but my question then becomes, where is the pink elephant that I am beholding? That's the question.
Right.
Okay, and this becomes then an argument for the existence of the mind, right?
Yes. So, and my challenge comes in, and this is something that I've heard a few times before. I'm a software developer, so in my field of expertise, and the people that I talk to, is pretty common. They'll say, yeah, but I could put a pink elephant on your computer screen or your phone screen, and you can behold it there, and in a sense, the phone is beholding it.
Wait, stop for a second. I just want you to repeat a sentence. You said the what is beholding it, the phone?
Wait. And yeah, you could say the phone is, well, I guess the proper word would be displaying it.
Yes, beholding and displaying is very different. Yes, of course, but beholding and displaying is very different. I agree with all that's been said so far, and the counterexample is fine. I don't see how it in the slightest way undermines my point. You can put it on the screen. So it's fair to ask, where is the image? The question that we're asking is, where is the image that is being beheld? In the case of the image on the screen, the image is on the screen. There it is. You're pointing at it. Great. Where is the image that's in my mind?
Right. So I think what people would say is it is simply a virtualization of the different data bytes in your brain, kind of concluding in a pink elephant in kind of your mind's eye there.
Yes, but that's exactly my point. It is a, what was the phrase you used? You said it first. It was a data, what did you say? I should have written it down.
Data, basically.
Yeah, look at it. No matter how you characterize it, no matter what mechanism produces it, it doesn't matter to me. Sounds like you're sawing on something. Are you sawing on something?
I'm not sawing on something. I am by the water, though.
Oh, okay. I hear this. Reet, 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 reet. Okay. It doesn't matter how it's produced. You may not know anything about how computers work, but you can see on the screen a picture of a pink elephant. So when I ask, where is the image, you say the image is on the screen. Fine. Doesn't matter how many zeros and ones were involved in producing the image. I'm asking about the image itself. And so when I picture a pink elephant in my mind's eye, all right, that's just a way of referring to it because it does look like the kind of thing you could see with your eye, but you're not using your eye. You see a picture, and it's not as vivid as with your eye, but it is a picture. So my question is, where is the picture? It does not matter how the picture is produced. It could be zeros and ones. It could be the C fibers firing in your brain. It does not matter what's going on in your brain for my question. My question is, where is the image? And the image is not in your brain. Even if all these C fibers firing create the image or participate in creating the image, the question is, where is the image we are seeing? I am not seeing C fibers firing. I am not seeing blood and gray matter and vessels, etc. I am seeing a pink elephant. Where is it? That's the question. And they can't answer that if they're physicalists. It is somewhere because we've beheld it. If they put it on a screen, there it is. I can see it with my eyes, my physical eyes, because it's in a physical location. But if I'm not seeing it with my physical eyes, I'm seeing it with my mind's eyes, where is the location? It is no place physical. Because if it was someplace physical, you could go in principle to that physical place where it was located and see it. But that you can't do that. So
okay, so you would say pretty much everything that you kind of behold in your imagination is kind of within the mind, not the brain.
I don't know. Well, I know it's not in the brain. I wouldn't just say it. It isn't in the brain, and the reason I know it's not in the brain is because you could never find any of those things you imagine as you're imagining them in your brain. All you have in your brain is gray matter and blood and C fibers firing. I'm not sure. Is there any way that you can stop, do something about that noise?
There's a boat going by.
Oh, are you outside? Is that it?
The other way, maybe.
Okay. You know, it's crazy with cell phones. Sometimes the outside noise is more vivid than the person talking, and that's the way it was there for a moment. Okay, there you go. It sounds like somebody knows. Is that an ambulance? Okay, but you see the point that I'm talking about. That the point that I'm making is that we are actually beholding something. And I have made the point that you can do this with any of your five senses. You can smell a rose, you can taste a strawberry, you can feel fur, you can hear Beethoven's Fifth. Did you hear it? Dun 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 dun! Right in your mind. You don't need a sound to accomplish that. You can hear it in your mind. All of these,
right.
And you could see a pink elephant. But all of these are palpable sensations, but they are not happening anywhere physically, is my point. And if they are not happening physically and they are happening, they must be happening in some kind of non-physical realm. And if it's not my body that is beholding it, there must be something about me that is capable of beholding the non-physical realm. And that is something also that is not physical. It is my immaterial self.
Right, that makes sense.
Yeah, and there's a lot of other arguments that are available to us to make the case for the existence of the soul. I mean, near-death experiences are another example of that. And we have veridical characterizations or truthful experiences, and I say truthful, we know we can measure, we can test them, of people whose self has left their body. And I'm not talking about people who are, you know, they think they've died and gone to heaven and they see a light and they see a figure who they call Jesus and et cetera, and the Hindus call him Krishna or whatever. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about when a blind guy comes out of his body during an operation and then can look and see all the different colors and things that people are wearing and doing and then go back in his body and describe them. I'm talking about remote viewing, where they can go to outside of the hospital across town and sit in and listen to a conversation. And then when they come back to their body, they can report everything that took place in that conversation. You can check it out to see if that conversation took place just the way they reported. The answer is yes, it has. So this seems to me to be evidence, bare minimum, that the self, there is a self that is not physical. Because the physical body can be completely inert, and the self can be out and about viewing things it can report on later that can be tested. And so that's another piece to the puzzle. That's another evidential piece. We have a number of reasons to believe that the soul exists, and partly because we constantly experience it. You and I are experiencing our soul right now, and there are all kinds of things about our soul that we're experiencing that aren't necessarily physical. My thoughts aren't physical. They don't have any weight. They don't have any chemical characteristics. They have propositional characteristics. They have content. But they are not...
Right, and I find that the thought argument there is definitely the most persuasive. A lot of my colleagues end up being very hard atheists and materialists, and I just get stopped right at the point of there's no immaterial world at all.
Why? Why do you get stopped? Why do they say this? This is what gets me about this, Dave, is that the view that there is no soul is rather new, okay, in terms of being popular, because people they know that the existence of the soul is obvious. It's the one thing that we are in touch with every waking moment of our lives, and even non-waking moments we're in touch with. Okay, we are not aware of our bodies when we're asleep. We're aware of our souls. And the content of our souls and dreams, okay? And so why is it that people deny the obvious is the question. And the answer is because they have a prior commitment to materialism. Okay, I get it. Okay, why do you believe materialism? Not you personally, Dave, but why do they, what is it that compels them to believe in materialism such that they disqualify the experience of the immaterial realm? No, I know what they're going to say.
A lot of the time it's experience.
Pardon me?
I know a lot of the time, Canada is an interesting case in that a lot of people I meet here in Vancouver have experience with the church, and it's usually negative experience.
Okay.
And because of that, I think they go more towards the material side.
Well, see, how is it that if you have a negative experience with a group of people, you therefore believe that immaterial things don't exist? This to me doesn't connect. It doesn't compute, I should say. That does not compute. Do you see what I'm saying?
That's the best that I get.
Well, if that's what they're giving you, it's not very good, it seems to me.
Yeah.
Here's what's... I'll have to go after I mention this, but this is what comes to mind for me about the reasons that materialists will say that they don't believe in the immaterial realm. And what they say is, well, I experience the material realm. I don't experience the immaterial realm. My five senses can get at the material realm, but they can't get at the immaterial realm. And it is so bizarre when I think about it. It is so bizarre because they experience the immaterial realm all the time. And in fact, if you listen to their language, you will hear it. Years ago, I had a caller that was making this case. He was an atheist, materialist, and didn't believe in the soul and was rejecting everything that I had to say about the soul. But he said, "No, that's not real. That's just he'd say things like, "That's just a thought." I'll say, okay, I say, well, how much does a thought weigh? No, that's just an abstraction. Okay, what is an abstraction? Every single time he tried to dismiss some element of the immaterial world, he replaced it with another element of the immaterial world. He couldn't get around it. And people are talking about these things all the time. Their language is absolutely chock full with references to the immaterial realm. But they're, because they experience it on a regular basis. But then they have the temerity, it seems, to deny the existence of the immaterial realm because they're not experiencing it. This is nonsense.
Yeah.
It's so obvious, it seems to me, and this is why from time immemorial humans have known they have a soul. The only way they can get out of that is when they're talked out of it by some materialist with a bad argument. All right?
Yeah. I think the word I hear more often is probably virtualization or something to do with technology, but
yes.
I'm not sure if that's the same as saying it's an abstraction or not.
Well, I don't know how that helps them. It's virtual. Yes, I agree. It's not. It is virtual. But what is the virtual thing that is being presented to us? It's an image. And when it's presented virtually, we can identify its location on the screen. When it's virtual inside of us, we still have to ask the question, then where is the screen that we are seeing this virtual image on? Yes, it's virtual. It's not a real elephant. A real elephant's not going to fit inside my head. Actually, the image isn't in my head either, but you know what I'm talking about. It's a virtual. The question is, where is the virtual image? That's what the question really ought to be. And if it's not in a physical realm, it's got to be in the non-physical realm. That's the only realm that's left.
I think they might also say it could be in a simulation. So the simulation could be happening somewhere on a server, and it's not actually, maybe it is, maybe it isn't being displayed on a screen, but the simulation could contain the data bytes representing elephants and grass and trees and water, and could simulate the life of an elephant.
But see, the thing is
so maybe the color
they're talking about how the image is produced. Data bytes. I don't see data bytes. I see an image. Oh, these data bytes stimulate such. Okay, good. I agree. Everything that you said they might say, I can completely agree on, and it doesn't get them anywhere. Yes, all those things are stimulating, doing, working, data bytes, blah, 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 blah. To produce an image. Where's the image? That's the question.
All right. Use that one then.
Yeah, do the best you can and see what happens. There are some people who get this. They see it and they realize, you know, you got a good point there. And last I heard, this was a philosopher who got it, not a zeros and one person, not a computer person. Just because you can describe in all of these mechanistic ways how the image is produced does not allow you to dismiss the image. And that's what they're trying to do. All right? The image is there. Where is it? Where is this thing? Okay, I sound like a broken record. I think you got the point, right, Dave?
Yes.
All right, buddy.
And it was great talking to you.
Thank you so much.
And, yeah, I just wanted to say your ministry has been an amazing blessing to me. I kind of started listening to you around the time I became a Christian shortly after, and I think I couldn't even read a paper on philosophy before listening to your program, and then within just a couple weeks, I was able to, you know, debate free will and all that kind of stuff. So it's been amazing to me.
Wow. Well, that's great. I'm encouraged by that. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
All right. All the best to you. You know, sometimes people will say in a discussion like this, if I can show you a robot, if some machine ends up showing it conscious behavior, will you then concede that there is no soul? And my response is going to be, no, I won't concede there is no soul. What I'd have to conclude is the robot now has a soul. And it's not circular. It's the nature of consciousness is that it's not physical. Okay? And in fact, materialists think that we're just biological robots. That's what they think. Determined things. And that has consciousness. So all they've done is give me a different example of a material thing with consciousness when they point to a machine or a robot. Consciousness has certain qualities that cannot be reduced to something physical. And believe me, the other side has tried to do it. The best they can do now, and this is Daniel Dennett, is to say, well, it's just all an illusion. And I pointed out before, when Daniel Dennett, you can Google him, Daniel Dennett, D-E-N-N-E-T-T. Consciousness is an illusion. You could see him say it yourself. It's not Google, it's YouTube. And then you can ask yourself the question, or rhetorically, of Dr. Dennett. Dr. Dennett, what is an illusion? Isn't an illusion when your consciousness is being appeared to falsely? Can rocks have illusions? No. Only conscious creatures can have illusions. So how can consciousness be an illusion? What consciousness is having the illusion of consciousness? Is an illusion having an illusion? Do you see how ridiculous this is? But this is the lengths that they have to go, denying the obvious to hold on to their materialism. If a robot or any machine ever displayed genuine consciousness and not, you know, artificial intelligence. The A there in AI is there for a reason. It isn't the real thing. It's artificial. But real consciousness, real intelligence, if that actually happened, I have no reason to think it will. But if it actually happened, I would be convinced then, not that there was no soul in humans, but there now was a soul in the machine. Because conscious behavior, conscious things like thoughts and beliefs and acts of will and sensations and all of those things, these are all features of consciousness. They are not characteristic of mere matter, which is a good reason not to believe that only mere matter exists. Let's go to break, and then I'll come back for our final segment here on Stand to Reason.
Carry STR with you by downloading our Stand to Reason and Quick Reference apps for free. Both are available for iPhone, iPad, and Android. From your STR app, listen to the weekly podcast, speaker podcast, check out the STR blog, access Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letters, and more. The Quick Reference app gives you the tools you need to answer the toughest questions Christians face, all through the easy-to-read text and short videos. You'll have STR resources at your fingertips in a clean layout with great features and functionality. And they're free. So download the apps today and start carrying STR with you everywhere you go.
There's always something new for you on the STR.org homepage, where you'll find sound analysis and careful commentary on the issues challenging Christians today. Along with new articles each month from Greg, Brett, and Alan, you'll also find new blog posts every day, new podcasts and featured articles each week, a new featured resource each month, and updated news about local and online events. So take a few moments to browse the STR.org homepage and see what's new today. And keep coming back to stay informed and encouraged as you grow as a Christian ambassador. Stop by today and every day at STR.org.
Back with you here on Stand to Reason. Just a little update on some of the things that are happening. Let's see, on the 17th of February, that's a week from tomorrow, by my reckoning, I'll be at Living Oaks Community Church in Newbury Park, California, my home church. Ongoing conference the last few weeks. I'll be kind of anchoring. Actually, be one more session after I'm done on the resurrection. But I'll be talking about the Columbo Tactic, and I'm really looking forward to it. It's my home crowd, and I love teaching on this particular topic, and there'll be an hour and a half of talking and half an hour of interaction and Q&A. It's going to be a great evening. I'm looking forward to that. Newbury Park, California, Thousand Oaks area, roughly, and that's the 17th, Wednesday night. On the 26th, I will be at the Ligonier National Conference in Orlando, Florida. Out to March, I'll be at Mount Olives Lutheran Church in Mission Viejo, California, on the 3rd and 4th. Is that like a Saturday and Sunday thing? I know that, or maybe Friday, Saturday? Yeah, okay. I know I'll probably be overnight. And then on the 11th and 12th of March, I'll be at the Biola Apologetics Tactics. I'll be delivering the Biola Apologetics Tactics course in La Mirada, California. And then on the 17th through the 20th, I'll be at Elgin First Baptist Church in Elgin, Iowa. All of these details are on our website at str.org/training/events. And you can also find Brett and Alan and Tim Barnett on the same page. So that's one-stop shopping there for events. Don't forget about STR's Cruise Conference coming up August 6th through 13th, and let me give you a little rundown of what we're doing there. I haven't gone into this detail much in the past, but I have mentioned that our speakers are going to be J. Warner Wallace from Cold Case Christianity and John Stone Street from the Chuck Colson Center for Christian Worldview. Of course, we're having J. Warner do his cold case approach as a detective, the cold case reliability of the Gospels. And I endorse his book, Cold Case Christianity, which covers the reliability of the Gospels. This his own journey with going from an atheist to a Christian by using his exceptional skills as a storied cold case detective in Los Angeles County, and then convinced in the reliability of the Gospels by using that. And he's also, so that's one of his talks. Another one is Cold Case Resurrection. And I think it's the best presentation on the resurrection I've ever seen. And that's going to be his contribution to our time there on the cruise. Let's see, John Stone Street of the Chuck Colson Center for Christian Worldview. You know him from Breakpoint and Summit Ministries. He's going to be talking about entertaining entertainment, amusing ourselves to death. And he's also going to be talking about God's audacious plan to change the world through everyday people. I will be finishing up the program with a Credo, the Story of Reality, and this is coming from the book that I've been writing here of late. I haven't been posting on Twitter or my Facebook or anything because I've been just really absorbed in getting this work done. I'll be teaching on that, and I'll also be doing a teaching on critical thinking, and I call it the Primer on Clear Thinking. The dates for that's August 6th through 13th, and of course the full complement of ports: Juneau, Alaska, Sitka, Alaska, Ketchikan, Alaska, Victoria, B.C., departing from Seattle, returning to Seattle. So it's going to be a great time. Please check us out online for that. You can go to inspirationcruises.com/STR, inspirationcruises.com/STR, or you can contact them directly by just dialing 800-247-1899. And I think that brings us up pretty much up to date on the things that are happening here. Let's see. I have been asked a question here that this is a good time to respond to this. Apparently, I have been talking. Well, not apparently. I do, and the question identifies this, that it's better to read sections of Scripture and focus on sections of Scripture than it is to focus on verses. And I have raised a concern about daily devotionals, and this isn't warranted with every devotional, but some of the most popular ones, it's a problem, and that is that they offer you verses that oftentimes are kind of pulled out of context, and therefore their commentary and application that they have in the devotional has little to do with the meaning of the text as it was originally given by an author, and that's a big, big problem in my view. It might be that their point is a good one, and it's an example of right sermon, wrong text. But at very best, it encourages bad habits by Christians, and at very worst, they are actually giving a sermon that is not justified by any text whatsoever, certainly not the one that they're using. So that's a liability. And so how do we avoid that? Well, you know the principle that I talk about. Never read a Bible verse. That is, if you want to know what a verse means, that you have to read a paragraph at least. And if you're looking at narrative, you need to read a whole chapter or more. And one of the most troubling misuses of Scripture, and I'm not going to get into the details, but you know the verse I'm talking about, or you probably know, Jeremiah 29:11, is one that has suffered abuse largely because Christians have not started at the beginning of that chapter and then gone past their verse, because there's a lot more going on there that applies to how to understand that verse. That's not just right in that verse. It's right at the beginning and all the way through for quite a while. There's that, and I think if people were just in the habit of doing that more often, then they would not make so many blunders when it comes to using Scripture. The other thing about Jeremiah 29:11 is, as you're leading into that verse, God says, "I will fulfill my good word to you," which seems to suggest that what he's about to say, the plans for a future and a hope, etc., are something that he has spoken of in the past. I will fulfill that good word to you. Well, that good word is in Deuteronomy chapter 30, and almost a precise parallel there, a word line for line, you find there in chapter 30 of Deuteronomy, and being revisited, those concepts there in Jeremiah 29. Anyway, the broader point, as I've said before, read larger sections to have a better chance of understanding the truth. Well, given that principle, this pastor of worship, his name is Jeff, has asked, well, what are the top 10 chapters of the Bible that Greg would encourage a Christian to memorize? I don't memorize, for the most part, whole chapters of the Bible. I'm not that good. I do know a lot of passages, but most of them, just by meditation, reflection, and reading, they've just stuck with me. I haven't actually memorized them. But I will hazard a couple of passages that I think are worth spending time memorizing and letting them sink deeply into your consciousness. One is Psalm 23, and actually a few of these are Psalms. Psalm 23, the Shepherd's Psalm, I memorized this really when I taught it to my daughters. I had bits and pieces of it, like most of you, but I had to get an iteration of it right if I was going to teach this to my girls, and so I did. And I find that even at night when I'm drifting off to sleep, to calm my mind and to keep my thoughts on the Lord, I just slowly go through Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me lie down by green pastures. He leads me beside still waters. He restores my soul. Now, I recited a little bit of that for you on purpose to make a point, an additional point. It's not just knowing the passages, but what you want to try to do is to be able to say them and reflect on them in a way that emphasizes the meaning, puts life in them for you. I think Psalm 51 is an excellent psalm to remember, to memorize. It's David's own psalm of or confession before God after his sin with Bathsheba. The whole psalm is wonderful. The only parts I don't relate to is the short prayers for Israel, by your favor do good to Zion, the way it ends up. But be gracious to me, O God, according to your loving kindness, according to the greatness of your compassion, blot out my iniquity. Wash me thoroughly of my sin. I mean, aren't there dozens of times a day when we can recite those lines because we need to say them before God? Well, I just started reading it every day. I went for, actually, it was last year when I started to do this, as we approached Easter for Lent. I was reading it every single day, and it stuck. Pretty soon I could pretty much recite the whole thing without much help. Well, those are two places to start. Psalm 1 is great as well, and these are psalms you could teach your kids, so I recommend those kinds of things. Find the place that really meets your spiritual need and focus in on that. Let it become part of you, and it will bring life to you in that way. That's it for today, my friends. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven. Bye-bye now.
Listening to Stand to Reason. Listen to a new one-hour podcast every Wednesday and Friday. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by giving a gift online at str.org.